Let's call this meeting to order. And we got minutes we got to approve?
What?
It wasn't very good.
Mary Murphy, did you read the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the minutes as printed.
Very well. Mary Murphy moves we adopt the minutes from January 30th, right? Yeah. All in favor of that signify by saying aye. Aye. Pass. Now we have the State Arts Board, right? Where's our State Arts Board? Can't wait to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. Thank you so much for this opportunity to give you a very brief overview of who we are and what we do. For some of you, this will be a refresher, and possibly for some of the newer members to this committee, this will be a first time that you've heard about the work that we do. I'm going to talk very briefly about how we're structured and what our responsibilities are, and then I'll talk a little bit about how we have been investing the legacy funds that have been entrusted to us since 2010 when the legacy amendment was passed. The Arts Board is a non-cabinet-level state agency. We exist within the executive branch. Our mission, as spelled out in state statutes, is to stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts throughout the state of Minnesota. We have a set of responsibilities and roles, and our structure is outlined in state statute as well. For those of you who have heard me present before, you can close your ears now, but I will say the thing that I always love to say, which is Minnesota was the second state in the nation to create an agency within state government to focus on the arts. We did that in 1903. So we have a very long track record of working with and trying to support a strong and vibrant arts community here in the state of Minnesota. The Arts Board is a board. We have 11 positions, all of whom are appointed by the governor. We actually have one vacancy at the moment. If you're curious about who is serving on our board, you can open up that hyperlink, and it will give you a list of our current board members, and it will tell you a little bit about their backgrounds and their terms. We have a staff of 19 members at the Arts Board, full-time staff. And we also have in statute the ability to use advisory committees. And we refer to these as our citizen review panels. We think that this is one of the great strengths and one of the unique features about our process. The Arts Board uses about 250 volunteers per year to help us review applications. In the last fiscal year, 2016, those individuals contributed more than 11,000 volunteer hours to the work that we do. We think it's really important for Minnesotans to play a role in helping decide how funds are spent. And those individuals come from all over the state, from Crookston, International Falls, Grand Portage, all the way down to the southern part of the state to Worthington and Wyckoff. Large communities and very small communities, and I've looked up a few of them, Earhart, Revere, and Easton, towns of less than 200. Yeah. We try to have those committees be reflective of the state's population. We have 9 key duties in statute.
Did you say that was Easton?
Easton.
My district.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All 199 people of it.
Oh, I had 194. I missed 5 of them.
I'll introduce you next time I see you.
Wonderful. I look forward to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. State statute outlines 9 key responsibilities for the Arts Board, and I have highlighted the 3 that really are the core of our activities on a day-to-day basis. First and foremost, we are known as, and our primary work is to distribute grants to individuals, to organizations, to public agencies, tribal governments, throughout the state of Minnesota. And one thing that I think is really remarkable is that 94% of the dollars that come to the Arts Board leave our office in some form of a grant. So that really is the core of what we do. We also are an advisor, a resource to other state agencies, other public agencies, other nonprofits that have issues related to the arts. And we serve as the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils that are located throughout the state. And here is the map of those councils. Again, Minnesota was one of the pioneers. We created this decentralized structure in the 1970s. And we did so, and I'm sorry Representative Kahn isn't here. She used to tell this story much better than I did. But it was done so that there would be purposeful investment at the local level. that those regional arts councils are not satellites of the state arts board. They're not employees of the state. They're separate 501c3 organizations. They have their own boards. They have their own staffs. And it's their job to assess the needs and opportunities of the part of the state that they serve. They develop the grant programs and services that they want to deliver, and they have local authority to make decisions about how to spend those dollars. So we don't control that. We do receive a two-year biennial plan, so they're all now putting their plans together for the 18-19 cycle. We'll review that. We'll make a block grant to each of them, and then we will follow through with them over the next 2 years as they implement those plans and spend those dollars. We receive reports, financial reports, narrative reports, certified audits from them, and we work very closely with them. I meet with them every month. I talk to them more frequently than that, and so we have a very long-standing, close relationship. I wanted to talk a little bit about the appropriations and the investments that we are receiving and making. So this first slide, I think it's always helpful to see the whole picture of what the Arts Board is and what it does. The bottom columns, the darker green, are general fund appropriations. You'll see, and I apologize for small type when I put a lot of information on one graph, the type gets small. In 2000-2001, we were receiving just over $26 million in general fund appropriations. You'll see that it fell off quite considerably in the 2004-2005 cycle, and we made a little bit of progress back up, and then it's gone down a little bit since then. But I do believe that that drop-off in 2004-2005 was a great motivator for people in the arts community who care about the arts to really get behind the Legacy Amendment when it was a campaign and to say that they wanted there to be stable and even increased funding for activities and programs that they think are valuable. You'll see now that legacy funds are the majority of what we receive each year. The appropriated amount for this biennium is $73 million. We have about $72 to spend because of the 3% set aside and some of the reductions in legacy, but that's where we are at the moment. Again, this gives you the...
Why just a 3% set aside? It's requested you have a 5%.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear that.
Why just a 3% set aside when it's requested that you have a 5%? Did you get special permission or dispensation that you don't need to have the full 5%? Or you just never use it?
Mr. Chair, at the beginning of the fiscal year, the Commissioner of MMB directed a 3% set aside for all Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund recipients. So that was not just the Arts Board, but the Historical Society and the Humanities Centers and others. The most current effort is looking at perhaps an additional set-aside on top of that 3%, and we haven't gotten guidance yet from Minnesota Management and Budget what that additional set-aside might be. But I don't believe we were treated any differently than any of the other agencies receiving legacy appropriations. Pardon me, Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund appropriations.
Okay. Good. Very well. I'll check into that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So then this gives you an overall picture also of grant making, and this is not just the Arts Board. This is the whole system, the Arts Board and the 11 Regional Arts Council systems. You'll see the general fund revenue, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund revenue, and we've the last column we're only giving you the first year of the biennium because obviously we are still in the second year. And we don't know yet exactly how many requests and how many grants there will be. I give you this slide really to point out two things that I think are most important. One is that you'll see the number of requests and the number of the grants that we make. We as a system are able to fund about 60% of the requests that we receive. So out of 7,600 proposals across the system in 2 years, we fund about 4,500 grants. The other number that I think is important on this slide is if you look at the dollars requested in 2014-2015, it was $101 million. The 2018-2019 projected revenue for Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is about $125 million. So the requests that we get are about 80% of everything that's available in the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. So there is a significant demand. There are many, many valuable projects, many valuable arts organizations and artists who we just are not able to fund, but we try to make the dollar stretch as far as we can. I'm going to very briefly give you some examples. The numbers are great, but the examples of what actually is being funded, I think, often is even more interesting. Since 2010, the first year of the Legacy Amendment, the appropriations that we've received have really mirrored the language in the state constitution. So we receive part of the appropriation is designated for arts and arts access, part of it is designated for arts education, and part of it is designated for arts and cultural heritage. And so I'm going to give you just a few examples of some of the things that are being funded out of those. This is a program with senior citizens. One of the wonderful things about legacy funds is that we have been able to start funding arts activities taking places in non-traditional locations. So theaters, concert halls, museums, all of those things still are happening. But one of the things that has been possible since the legacy fund is the ability to provide arts programming at senior centers like the one that you just saw, or arts programs with organizations that work with people with disabilities or homeless youth. So arts experiences for underserved audiences is one of the things that we're seeing that we really hope is meaningful. The other thing that we're doing with arts and arts access dollars is touring artists around the state. We think that it's really important to try to share the wealth and for artists to have a chance to meet and work with new audiences. Some of those might be very small. There's an artist who lives in Edina, I believe, in Representative Anselmo's district, who wrote a one-man show about his grandfather. It's called The Accidental Hero. His grandfather, had a key role to play in a battle during World War II. It's toured all through Minnesota. It has become so popular that it's toured outside of the state and has toured in Europe several times, not with legacy money. It has only toured in Minnesota with legacy money. But it's really become very popular, and it's become something that people can connect to, that story about the connection with World War II. But this program also funds larger organizations to tour. So when the Minnesota Opera goes to Duluth, or when the Minnesota Orchestra goes to Bemidji, or to Detroit Lakes for a week, those kinds of activities are coming out of that fund. We also provide support for the ongoing activities of some of the most important arts organizations in the state, and the regional arts councils do the same thing. So the Northern Light Opera in Park Rapids, Grand Rapids Players, State Street Theater in New Ulm, the Fairmont Opera House, Linden Hills Chamber Orchestra. Smaller organizations are receiving that vital, ongoing, mission-driven support from their regional arts councils, and larger organizations are receiving that from the Arts Board. This is actually a photo from the Minnesota Orchestra's residency, Common Chord's residency in Bemidji 2 years ago. So in arts and education, we're really trying to focus on lifelong learning in the arts, not just programs for K-12 age students, but if our sort of slogan is whether you're 3 weeks or 103 years old, you know, is there a place for you to learn to paint, learn to play the violin, learn to play the piano, learn to write a poem? And so we're doing a variety of things with that. The Arts Board has been funding some very large arts education partnerships. One of the examples is the McPhail Center in Minneapolis, the largest community music school in the country. It developed an online distance learning program that we have funded a number of times. And what that does is it uses live video conferencing so that the teachers at McPhail can teach with Greater Minnesota teachers, works one-on-one with the students, but it also provides support for those teachers who might need some assistance or some guidance. The program started in the Kirkhoven-Murdoch-Sunberg district and has now expanded. There are additional districts that they're trying to bring online with that program. The Regional Arts Council level, they have funded a number of school residencies where an artist or an arts company will be in a school for a few days or for a week, sometimes working with Castlake Bina High School, had an artist come in and write a play about the issues that teens are facing. Or Frazee Vergas Public Schools had the Copper Street Brass come in for a couple of days and work with the students, give them master classes, give concerts, those sorts of things. And we've very intentionally been funding community arts education. I'd mentioned whether you're 3 or 103, where do you go to learn the arts? So we've funded places like McRosty in Grand Rapids, the St. Francis Music Center, Headwaters School, Arts Center of St. Peter, just different places around the state where you can learn an art form if you choose. And then our last area, arts and cultural heritage. So preserving Minnesota's history and cultural heritage through the arts. How do we bring people together with a celebrated history, a celebrated sense of identity? This is a mural that's in Duluth. It's at the Laura MacArthur Elementary School. It's called Peacemakers. It was funded by one of the regional arts councils. And you'll see that public art is one of the things that the regional arts councils have been investing in. So an artist from Waseca was commissioned to do a mural in Blue Earth. An artist in Minneapolis worked with the Calhoun Area Residents Action Group to do a mosaic mural at Bryant Square Park in Minneapolis, and then the one you just saw from Duluth. The Arts Board, we are funding folk and traditional arts as well, and I hope you had in your packet this little brochure. We don't do a lot of high glossy printing. We have a color copier that we do most of our things on, but we did make a nice brochure. This is artists and organizations that have been funded in our folk and traditional arts program in the last few years, and we had a showcase, and some of this work is still up in our office. But I wanted you to see this, to see some of the variety and the quality of work that's being funded out of folk and traditional arts. And then, of course, arts festivals. That's a great place for people to come together and bridge differences, get to know not only other cultures, but get to know one another, get to know one's neighbors through an arts experience. So I always leave you with my favorite slide, which is about the numbers of people that we serve. Because we aren't just one organization, we are really 12 organizations. And our combined funding in the last completed biennium was just over 25 million people. All of the classes, all of the outreach activities, all of the performances, all of the exhibitions, all of those things together really has a significant impact on people living and working here in Minnesota. So the 74 million dollars is really significant. It, in the grand scheme of the state's $45 billion budget, it might seem small as you're looking at much larger numbers. But for us, the impact is huge. For the people who are affected, the impact is huge. In 2008, Minnesotans voted to increase funding and provide stable funding for arts, arts education, arts access, and to use the arts to preserve our history and our cultural heritage. We are trying to do the best we can to spread those dollars around. I was having a conversation with somebody earlier today. There is no one art program that is right for everyone. Everyone has different interests, different needs, different ways that they want to interact with the arts. And so we hope that by using this really sophisticated system to deliver grants, that we are trying to provide the greatest benefit to the greatest number of Minnesotans. And I will stop there, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from members? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that presentation, Ms. Jones. I have a couple of questions. The legislative audit report that came out, and as you know, there's the law was passed that says if you're not in compliance, according to the legislative auditor, you can't receive funds. And it seems like you still had two discrepancies. Have you been trying to deal with those? One was from the Asian Media Access and then the Pan-Asian Alliance.
Ms. Jen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Green, we believe that we have addressed all of the findings at this point. The audit report was from the fall of 2015. And so on that one in particular, we have now closed both of those two grants. And if funds were due back to the state, those have been returned, or in the case of those organizations, they are not going to be eligible to apply in the future if the funds don't come back. So we believe that those two have been resolved. And we've also addressed the findings related to the regional arts councils and the oversight of the councils. So we're making progress on getting those completed.
Representative Green.
Okay, and then so can I get the verification of the compliances that you say you put in place, and then also on the other aspects that you were talking about? Are you talking about the administrative costs that there was a discrepancy as to where the legacy funds were being used, and that some of them may have been used in to to supplant the existing administrative cost. Is that what you're talking about when you say you're working on the other issue?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Green. The legislative auditor came back and did some follow-up. I think because of the law and the auditors needing to go back and see how progress is being made on findings, they looked at the first and the third finding. And so those are the places where we believe we have things in place now that have satisfied those two findings. The question about supplement versus substitute for was a place where the auditors felt that they were going to need to refer some of that question back to the legislature, not just for us, but with some other issues that they're finding. Because in our case, in the case of the Arts Board, what they found is that we were meeting the test that all of the funds that we were spending were directly related to and necessary for administering the funds, which was language that was put into the law when Representative Erdahl was chair of the committee. And that made perfect sense, that every agency has different kinds of needs, and it will spend those administrative dollars on different kinds of things. And so that test of what is directly related to and what is necessary for was important. In our case, the legislature has continued to place a cap on the amount of money that we have available for administrative costs. And so there really are two steps in place to say we're spending money on things that are directly related to and necessary for, and we are not exceeding the cap that is in the law. The question about supplement versus substitute comes down to things like, can legacy money be spent on my salary, the executive director's salary? Can legacy money be spent on rent? Can legacy money be spent on IT? And an argument can be made that you had an office, you had a staff before the legacy amendment passed. Should any of those funds be able to be spent on those kinds of costs? We have felt, and in fact the Minnesota Management and Budget guidance on legacy funds has said, that if those costs are necessary in order to manage legacy funds, then it should be allowable to charge some of those costs, which is what we're doing. And so I think the question is, what did you all mean by supplement versus substitute? And would it, if we were to take a really hard line on that question, would we have needed to lay off all of our staff members and move to a different office and get completely different IT setups in order to comply with what could be a sort of a clear line about that? And I think because there hasn't been a lot of guidance, we have been charging those costs that we really think are directly related to managing the legacy funds, to administering the funds.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, I think we're getting a little bit into the weeds there as far as splitting things up, because I think it's pretty much been determined, and I think that we know from the start, that if you have administration cost directly related to legacy, then those should be charged to legacy. That's not really the question. The question was that, you know, are there documentations to prove? And I think that there were discrepancies in the report. And I don't have the first report that came out, but I believe that it was into the many hundreds of thousands, if I believe, that were being paid in different organizations as well. In some cases, even for paying into pensions, good shares of pensions. And so what we need to know is if you're documenting those now and if you've gone back and fixed those other problems. In the question of the two entities that were not in compliance, to say you're not going to give them any more money, I'd have to see what you've got in your records and see if that complies with the law that says that as an agency you can't receive more money if you're not in compliance. And I think, and whether this was put out in November of 15 or not, I just got it. I mean, I just received this. And according to this, you were not in compliance on those two issues, so I'd like to see that if I could.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to get you that information. I'm also happy to come and meet with you and answer any other questions that you'd have about the audit.
Thank you.
Very well. Any other questions from members? Representative Willie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. I was wondering, you have 7,000 or so different entities that are, you're granting out to and such. Is there like a, and maybe you mentioned that I mentioned, or missed it, but, you know, like, you've got about 17 of them in here. It'd just be kind of neat if you had a way, you know, and I think it's possible in today's technology to have, like, a map of the state, and you could, you know, pop up, you know, type in different ones and just see what they're doing with the, you know, the grants. I know it's a lot, but I think it'd really be neat for and helpful in the future for telling your story, you know, of what's going on beyond the, you know, the few that you mentioned. But, I mean, there must be just tons. Like, I didn't know woodworking was such a, or the bowl turning was such a, you know, you have two of those in here. But a lot of them are, would be just interesting to have that. If it was some, maybe you have a system already, and I don't know. So I guess that'd be my question. Do you have a system already, and is there any effort to kind of record some of that, that the public could kind of see what, and then us as committee members could see what you're, where the grants are going and what you're doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, thank you for that question. We don't have an online technology right now that maps all of the projects or all of the things that have been funded. It is certainly one of the things we would like to be able to build. The only place that that's available at the moment is on the Legacy website, where all of our grants and all of our Regional Arts Council grants are listed. But I think to your point, and this for us is possibly a happy problem, that when we, let's say, for example, we fund an organization like, we fund the American Swedish Institute. Every single thing that they do could potentially be on a website. So how would we do that in a way that makes sense? But we do want to create something like that that starts to highlight some of those projects and helps Minnesotans find the things that they're being involved in. We do encourage, beyond encourage, we put in our grant contracts that the Legacy logo needs to be used on any project. So we are trying to have all of those individual grantees identify that this is a program that is being paid for with public dollars.
Thank you. Any other questions from members?
Yeah.
Representative Lehman.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your great presentation. I think that the legacy funding for the arts is making an impact in greater Minnesota. I think that it has an economic development impact. My region takes in part of Itasca and Cass County, and I've seen the impact with the McCroskey Arts Center and the Grand Rapids Players and so on, doing things above and beyond what they would have done otherwise, which I think is what the legacy is all about. I concur with Representative Lilly. It would be really helpful to get a better idea. I have somewhat of a grasp of how legacy is impacting District 5B, but I think it would help you tell your story if you could somehow, whether it's hard copy or online, let us know, so that we can really be cognizant of where, how those dollars are being spent in our district. It would be really helpful to me. And then just a question for you, because I had, when I was holding some town forums, I did have a question from some of the local groups that are receiving funding and a concern that that we don't stray away from the original intent. Without getting into too much detail, there was some discussion of money being spent for studies that maybe weren't directly related to programming and arts. So I'm just wondering how much control or strategy is involved from the Arts Board to the regional councils. I know that the regional councils, you said, have separate authority and boards and so on. But do you have direction that you give them and outcomes and that you are expecting them to achieve and kind of hold them accountable for that? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Director Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, thank you for that question. I wanted to circle back around to your first question about studies. I'd love to have a conversation with you about that because I'm not sure what that would refer to, and I'd love to understand that a little bit better. On your second question, we don't tell the regional arts councils what they should or should not do or can or cannot do with the funds. They're charged with doing a needs assessment in their regions and deciding how best to allocate the dollars, whether that's in direct grant programs or whether it's in direct services. They do that. We did, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils together at the beginning of the legacy funds, agree to 5 very large strategic goals that we are working on for the 25 years. The goals are things like making sure that the arts are interwoven into daily life. So the examples about programming for seniors or programming in community settings or programming with human service organizations, that helps us achieve that. We also are all working on the goal that all Minnesotans, no matter what their ethnicity, no matter what their age, no matter what their abilities, could participate in the arts. So trying to broaden and expand. So we have very broad 25-year strategic goals that we're working on together. And then the Regional Arts Councils, by law, have the authority to decide how best to allocate the dollars to reach those goals.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So do you, in the grant applications, do you ask the grant recipients to show how they're meeting those goals?
Director Jones.
Mr. Chair, yes. Each grantee that we have at the Arts Board is asked to talk about what outcomes they intend to achieve, and they align with those 25-year goals. And then they also need to tell us in the application how they will measure whether they're achieving those goals. And then in the final report that they submit when the project is over, they tell us the degree to which they were able to achieve those outcomes that they set for themselves.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One thing I have noticed since the legacy started, including regional arts boards, is everybody that gets a grant writes a legislator, almost 100%, and tells us exactly what they did with their money and how they appreciate it. So I think, I don't know how that can be affected, but who's ever doing it's doing a great job. And any other questions from members? Well, thank you very much. It's been a very rewarding educational experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Next we have Minnesota's Citizens for the Arts presentation. Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gunther, representatives of the House Legacy Committee, and honored guests. I'm David Marty. I have the privilege of being the board chair of Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, which is a statewide arts advocacy group combining the interests and voices of the very largest and most important arts organizations in our state with the very smallest and most important arts organizations in our state together to speak with a unified voice of common concern. I'm also the president of the Rife Performing Arts Center in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which I'm delighted to report serves a very wide region in northern Minnesota. We have annually over 25,000 visitors from throughout the region and a total of between 7,000 and 8,000 students that we serve. Last Friday, for example, we had students coming in to see a performance of Alice in Wonderland from by the company Tout à Trac from Quebec, a company that we've been able to tour throughout the state. Our students come from a very broad region, not only from the city of Grand Rapids, but also from Bemidji, Hibbing, Chisholm, Aiken, from Big Fork, from Deer River, as far away as International Falls, as far as 100 miles, for the opportunity to see live performing arts in our community. Arts education is an extremely important part of what we do. I had the opportunity just this past week of visiting the Kennedy Performing Arts Center in Washington, D.C. to attend an arts and education conference. And I think you should all sit up a little bit prouder as we talked about the state of Minnesota and the arts legacy funding. People from throughout the country revere the state of Minnesota and the legacy funding and what it has been able to do in our state, in our part of the country. It is considered, widely considered to be an extremely effective model, and we all should be very proud of being able to be a part of a state that's in which that's included, and as a committee, you should be so proud of being able to have hands-on part of doing that. The Legacy funding in Grand Rapids in particular has been able to support us in Minnesota Orchestra is joining us in May. We have an effective partnership with the Second Harvest Food Bank so that we can include as guests in performances people who otherwise would simply not be able to financially participate in programs at all. We have a partnership, a very effective partnership, with James Sewell Dance Company in our community. So they participate. They are in our community as arts, as dance instructors on a regular basis. They invite our students to Minneapolis to study and perform with James Sewell Ballet. These are all parts of what happens with legacy funding in our community. The Grand Rapids Arts and Culture Commission had a curiosity last year about what is the economic impact of the arts in our community, and a study was commissioned by the Arts and Culture Commission that reported, among other things, that in our community of 11,000 people, 139 jobs are directly related to the nonprofit arts and culture community, and an economic impact of over $5.1 million as a direct result of the nonprofit arts and culture element in our community. These are very, very important pieces. And I wish I could say that it was only in Grand Rapids because we're special, and we are special. But that story is replicated again and again and again throughout the state. It's a very important program. There's a lot going on. And to speak to that, I would be honored to introduce Sheila Smith, the Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, to speak on that a bit further.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name, please.
Chairman Gunther, members, my name is Sheila Smith. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. I'm also the Chair of the Creative Minnesota Project, and I'm delighted to be here today to give you guys the very first preview of this research that is not yet public. It will be released to the public on February 28th. The Creative Minnesota Project is a collaboration between many partners, including the McKnight Foundation, Jerome Target Bush Foundation, MARDAG Foundation, and also the Historical Society, State Arts Board, Regional Arts Councils, etc. This year we also had a great partnership going with the Regional Affairs Office of Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and also Minnesota Compass, which, as you know, is one of the state's best place to find really good data about what's going on out in our state to use for policymaking. The goal of the Creative Minnesota Project is, first of all, to provide excellent data for education, analysis, and advocacy. We had conversations 4 or 5 years ago as the Legacy Amendment was getting underway that we didn't really have good hard data about the nonprofit arts and culture sector in Minnesota, and that all of us needed better data for policymaking, education, and for advocacy. So we collaborated on this project. The first round of research came out in 2015, and the Economic Impact Study of Grand Rapids is an example of one of the 29 studies that came out in 2015. So the 2017 study will be released at Arts Advocacy Day on February 28th, and your constituents will be delivering to you a copy of the report the day it comes out. First of all, let's look at nonprofit arts and culture organizations in Minnesota. We found 1,601 participating arts and culture organizations in the state of Minnesota. In terms of the kind of organizations in Minnesota, performing arts is by far the most common. So theaters, community theaters, dance organizations, choirs, in particular choirs. It's said of Minnesota that choirs are to Minnesota what football is to Texas. We have a lot of performing arts organizations in every corner of the state. And then as you can see from this list, other types of arts organizations do take up the bulk of the nonprofit arts and culture sector. The second largest grouping is history and historical preservation, of which we had 232 participating organizations. And I'm using this phrase participating organizations because there are more organizations than 1,601. Those were the organizations for which we could get data. So think of this as the floor or the minimum number of organizations in the field. Arts and culture organizations come in many sizes. As you can see, they go from all the way under $25,000 annual budget to well over $10 million. the large number of small groups shows you sort of where the R&D sector of the nonprofit arts and culture sector is. People graduate from college, they start a small theater company, they give it a go for a couple years, it never gets a big budget and it might go away, but now and again one of those organizations will get some traction and start to grow into these other budget categories. And in fact, pretty much every organization in the 1601 organizations started out as some volunteer community effort that grew over time to have more and more support and more attendees. In total, 22 million attendees are served on an annual basis by these 1,601 organizations in every corner of the state. Of that, 3.8 million are K-12 students. So what's interesting to me about the 3.8 million students served is we only have roughly 900,000 K-12 kids in Minnesota. So on average, every kid is getting four experiences in the arts and culture from these nonprofits. In addition to those individuals, we have nearly 30,000 student group visits and 669,000 attendees at classes, workshops, and readings. These are people of all ages. People's desire to learn about the arts and culture or to experience a class on painting or what you may have, it doesn't stop when you graduate from high school. People have a lifelong interest in participating in the arts, and these nonprofit arts and culture organizations are facilitating and providing those experiences for all Minnesotans. Here's a number that kind of goes against common wisdom. It's often said that only rich people want to go to the arts, and we found from surveying over 6,000 attendees at nonprofit arts and culture events that 43% of attendees have annual household incomes of under $60,000 a year. Minnesota does slightly better than the national average in that respect in serving the whole community. Attendees spend on average $20.48 on their way to and on their way home from arts and culture events, not including the cost of a ticket. In the state of Minnesota, roughly 16% of attendees are non-local, that is, they're coming from outside of the state, and that's a good thing to note as we look into the next slide. Non-locals spend 80% more on their way to or are they on their way from a nonprofit arts and culture event. So you can see frozen locals spend about $17.83 per person. Non-locals spend over $33 per person. So it's a great economic development strategy for particularly small towns to look to attract folks to arts and culture events because they're going to bring spending to town that would not have otherwise been there. So what are these people spending money on their way to and on their way from an arts event? Well, it's all pretty much common sense. Say I wanted to go to an event at the Fairmont Opera House. I live in Forest Lake, so I'll drive down there, check into a hotel, probably meet up with some friends to go out to eat before the show, go to the show, and maybe at intermission get a pop and a souvenir. And afterwards, maybe we go out again to talk about what a fantastic experience we just had. Then we stay overnight in the hotel, next morning have breakfast, and then drive home. So you can see that at each step of the way, I've had an economic interaction with town that I wouldn't have had otherwise had it not been for that arts and culture event. So when we were doing the legacy amendment, the polling told us that there was not a conflict between outdoorsy people and arts and culture people. That, in fact, more or less they were the same people. It's people who like to get out of their house and go out and enjoy all the many wonderful things that quality of life in Minnesota offers, or they stay home in their Barca lounger. And here's an illustration of that difference. The arts have a huge economic impact in Minnesota. All in total, the new study will report a $2 billion in economic impact of the nonprofit arts and culture sector in Minnesota, in addition to the spending of individual and artists in Minnesota, and this is part of the brand new research that has not been done before. So the $2 billion simply is the addition of $820 million total budgets. What is the spending of arts organizations in Minnesota with no multipliers, just adding up all the budgets? $564 million in audience spending, as I just described. And then in addition to that, $644 million in artist and creative worker spending, renting studios, buying art supplies, things at the hardware store, et cetera. The great news for Minnesota, and this sets us apart from the rest of the Midwest, is that every region of Minnesota has a robust arts and culture economy, and I'll leave this slide up a little longer. On the right, you will see the Regional Arts Council regions. That's how we analyzed the data that we had in. And on the left, you'll see their ranking in terms of size of the arts and culture economic impact for that region. All of this economic activity, the visitors spending money in hotels, the artists buying art supplies and spending money on rent, generates on an annual basis $222 million in taxes and fees, including license fees, utility fees, filing fees, etc., which far exceeds the legacy investments in the state. So shifting gears just quickly is a quick look at the analysis of the artist community in Minnesota. We did a large survey of artists in Minnesota. 2,100 artists completed the survey of 5,000 some that began the study. And we found that 34% of self-identified artists in Minnesota are not making their living in the arts because they are retired, they're hobbyists, they're students. Of the total, about a quarter are employed as full-time as artists, and 42% are employed as part-time as artists. So we're going to look more at those folks who are making their living in some part in the arts. Who are creative workers? So we define creative workers as people who make their living wholly or in part by working for for-profits, nonprofits, or self-employed in creative occupations. And so here's a list of some of the occupations that we included, 41 occupations in total, including everything from architects and choir directors to set and exhibition designers, actors, dancers, choreographers, music directors, composers, camera operators, etc. All told, we found 104,000 people in Minnesota make their living in a creative occupation. And just like the economic impact, there are groups of artists in every corner of Minnesota. It's not simply a metro phenomena.
If I had to make out a grocery ad every week, which is kind of artsy, a little bit, put cuts and stuff, would I be considered an artist?
If you were a graphic designer at the newspaper, then you would be a creative worker.
Okay, no, I don't think I qualify. Representative Erdahl, you got a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Gunther around here is recognized as a very creative legislator. So I think that should fit into this category.
Well, because he's the chair of the Legacy Committee, I would include him as a creative worker.
The question, self-employed artists or self-identified artists in Minnesota, 24%. Do you have a number of how many that is, how many artists that would be?
It would be about a quarter of the 104,000, so about 26,000 people.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, so the total of creative jobs are all artists?
The creative workers are the 41 occupations on the previous page.
Full-time.
Who are creative workers? So these folks may work for the newspaper, or they may be in advertising, they may be in a design office, an architectural firm, or they may be in one of the 1,601 nonprofit arts and culture organizations. Like David here is a creative worker. I'm a creative worker.
Dancers,
etc. And then there's a large group of self-employed artists who, for example, someone who creates jewelry at home and sells it on Etsy, and they're doing such a fantastic job that they're making a living at doing that.
Mr. Chairman, so what is an artist? I mean, to me, an artist is somebody who paints pictures and portraits.
We view artists as people who create things that are new with their hands and their mind. It can be performance. It can be an object. It's not created by machine. It's created by human being, and it's unique in the world.
So if someone wrote a book and it was released, like, in next August, that would be an artist?
Yes. Representative Erdahl, authors are included in our list of creative occupations, which would make you an artist also.
Representative Erdahl, you want to give the name of the book, too?
Remains of Glory. I'm done.
All right.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
So the four most common creative worker jobs, that is a creative worker occupation for which someone's getting paid, are photographers, musicians and singers, writers and authors, and graphic designers. Here we have a map that shows total creative economy jobs by county. And I, although there is, of course, a very large contingent of creative workers in the seven-county metro area, this map is interesting to me because it shows the regional centers having very large groups of creative workers and then also a larger-than-average creative workers going up the spine of Minnesota, of 94. This very different-looking map shows you the density of creative workers in the workforce. So how many creative economy workers per 1,000 employed residents? And the map looks very different than the raw numbers of creative workers. You see very heavy density, of course, in Hennepin and Ramsey counties, but then you also see it in Carver, Cass, Martin, and Marshall counties, and, say, Cook County up on the North Shore surrounding Grand Marais. Here is a map showing the average hourly creative workers for creative economy workers, and I sat down and was looking at this data yesterday and found that there were very often in small rural counties where the average worker wage was pretty low, the creative worker wage was a little bit higher. Maybe, and it's because of those people being able to sell things on Etsy, it doesn't matter where you live, so creative worker can be a really great job in rural Minnesota. And finally, on the artist topic, artists volunteer much more in their communities than other Americans. At 88% of artists report that they volunteer at least once a week. That we have data that shows 35% of all Minnesotans volunteer and 25% of all Americans volunteer. So they're heavily invested in and participating in their communities. Minnesotans strongly believe the arts and culture are important to their quality of life, and I won't read all of these, but I just the one, 90% believe that arts and cultural activities help make Minnesota an attractive place to live and work. What's interesting about Minnesotans in regards to the arts, however, is that Minnesotans attend arts and culture events more often than other Americans. 76% of Minnesotans report attending nonprofit arts and culture events, whereas only 68% of all Americans report the same. And finally, that Minnesotans are more personally involved in creative activities in their daily lives than other Americans, Minnesotans at 63% and others at 49%. And also, I forgot to say earlier, Minnesota has a $2 billion economic impact from the nonprofit arts and culture. If you just look at arts organizations, Minnesota's arts economy is double that of Wisconsin, 10.5 times the arts economy of Kansas, and 12.5 times the arts economy of South Dakota. The arts and culture set Minnesota so far apart from surrounding states that it's one of the draws that bring people here because of our quality of life. Of course, we have the great outdoors, which we all cherish, but the arts and culture are also part of that.
Just out of curiosity, do you think, consider tourism as part of tourism venue? They say a tourist is somebody who travels 50 miles to go see an event.
Uh-huh.
Tourism is probably the biggest venue we have as far as arts and culture is concerned in that regard. They have a ton of people go a lot more than 50 miles to see.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I was at an economic development meeting in Fergus Falls the other day, and one of the presenters reported that people in rural areas will travel up to 2 hours for an arts and culture event. So it just goes back to making sure, I think, that we are promoting our opportunities beyond our borders. We'll bring more people here who spend money that they wouldn't otherwise spend.
We love those Iowa bullhead fishermen.
So the full report will be released on February 28th and will be available online at creativemn.org. This was just a rock skipping across the surface of the very deep data that will be available online after February 28th. And also I wanted to touch on that the results of this study are a combination of both original research, several large surveys of artists, and other deep dives that were done by the Creative Minnesota Project, but with our many partners' analysis of many sets of data that are available nationally from the U.S. Census, in particular, and public opinion polling provided by Minnesota Center for Survey Research.
Thank you very much. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was the question that I had, and I guess maybe you can clarify it a little more. When you did the polls, the 91% and the 76% on these last pages, and you took those polls within the arts community?
No, those are public opinion polling with the general public. Creative Minnesota did not conduct those particular public opinion polls. The Center for Survey Research project was done with the Minnesota State Arts Board. It was out with the Minnesota public, and it was incorporated in their larger annual, I think it's semi-annual, surveys of the Minnesota public.
Okay, thank you. Could you give me the website for that? And then back on page three, can I get that? You got performing arts are the most common, and arts and cultural organizations, and then it goes through the graph, 695 in the performing arts down to arts and cultural organizations under 25,000. Do you have a breakdown of what those are?
Which one of them?
Both of them.
You mean a list of the organizations that are included?
Yep.
That is not publicly available information, but I could see if I can pull it together for you.
Okay.
It's a large and unsightly data set, so I can pull. I'll pull down the list for you.
Okay, thanks. And then the last one on page 8, of the $2 billion, do you have any kind of an estimation on how much of that would be attributed to legacy funds? Because obviously the arts were on long before legacy was, and so and maybe it looks like Representative Erdahl might have the answer for me.
Well,
what are you raising your hand for?
Well, actually, Representative Green, the question that I would ask might or might not contribute to your answer that you are seeking.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I'm sorry, sir, I forgot your name.
David Marty.
Marty?
Marty, yeah.
You know Marty's around here. Mr. Marty, how many events, how many days are events held in the Rife Center in a year?
Mr. Gunther, representative, I believe it's, we have 45 touring events a year plus our local events. The center is in use at least 6 days every week.
Thank you, Mr. Marty, Representative Gunther. And I've been to the Rife Center, by the way.
Yes, you have, sir.
Part of a bonding trip, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Before the legacy amendment passed, do you recall how many days the Rife Center was being utilized? Was there a change?
There was definitely a change. I don't think, sir, that I can quantify exactly what that change is. But the change is in terms of not only number of events, but scale of events. I could try to find that information.
It might be interesting for myself or Representative Green. But so the point I was trying to reach there is that there has been a significant increase in the events and the quality of the events at the Rife Center.
Yes, sir.
Since the legacy amendment.
Yes, sir.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I liked your earlier comment on the ads for grocers.
Mm-hmm.
With my family newspaper, we used to do the layouts of those ads, and it was always fun finding clip arts for the certain type of coffee or whatever. And I would agree that those are actually pieces of artwork.
I consider them such.
It's pretty. It was a fun project. I really enjoy this report. I think it's really fascinating. I think we all appreciate most of us appreciate the quality of life impacts, but to put real numbers on them are, I think, interesting. Like on page 6 and 7, where you talk about the local versus non-local, and then how people spend money, This within the last year, I took a trip down to hear one of our fellow legislators, Representative Pulowski, to give us a talk on King Tut, I think it was. And so on the way down, I bought gas, and I stopped at grocery store, you know, or had treats. And then when I get down there, I listened to his thing, and then I went to that Marine Museum that they have down there, which is an amazing collection in Winona. And then, of course, I had to go to the bakery and then purchase something, you know, like a gift as well. And so anyways, it was all on one trip. But if you haven't had a chance ever to get down to that Marine Museum, I recommend that higher, or it's better than the Pulowski talk, we'll just say, but, you know, it's hopefully he's listening. But, no, I mean, the money, you know, you do spread it around, you know, more than, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly what that is supposed to, you know, I can see where you tried to break it down into different categories, but I know this is happening and it's real, but it's kind of nice to see that you're trying to put, you know, the money that's invested around our state based on this type of tourism or economic impact of the arts community, because I think we all get the quality of life, we can feel it, but to actually put numbers to it, I think is really good for the discussion. So thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, along the spirit of cultural diversity and such, and Representative Pulowski's talk on King Tut, did he dance like an Egyptian?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, he didn't have hard to imagine, but I know you know it's true. He had a little clip of that song.
Oh, okay.
That's, you know, from Saturday Night Live. I think he had that piece.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly spurred a question for me here that I hadn't thought about till now.
Whoops.
So thank you.
What a theme.
I hope I know the answer to this, but I will tell you, just as an example, in my area, we do a lot of arts, performing arts, but a good number of them are privately owned. And the question has arisen as the more of the entities get money from the state, you know, the public entities get money from the state to expand their organizations, it actually hurts the people who have been there for many years in the private sector. So when you did your studies and got your numbers, did you include the private as well as the public, or is this just people that receive money from the organization?
Representative Green, Minnesota Citizens for the Arts is not a grant maker.
Okay.
We did the research. At this point, we have only studied nonprofit arts and culture organizations. We haven't studied for-profit organizations, so I can't say anything in particular about the interaction there.
Okay, so then going back to the fiscal impact, then you don't really know if you've taken some of that money away from a private sector and just put it into a nonprofit, because if the nonprofit is there, you don't know if those people were already attending the private entities. But then it brings me back to the other question. If you could get me a breakdown of what you believe that $2 billion, share of that $2 billion would be legacy.
Well, I can give you a rough estimate now, Representative Green. In 2007, we did a similar economic impact study of only nonprofit arts and culture organizations in Minnesota and found an annual economic impact of $835 million. That number included both the organization spending and the audience spending. So if you add together the organization spending and audience spending from this study and subtract $835 million, you'll find the difference between 2007 and 2014 data. And that is the period in which legacy investments were being made in Minnesota. I think it's roughly $500 million difference in terms of size of the sector. However, I couldn't connect any single dollar to another dollar. It's an order of magnitude difference.
Okay. Well, then I guess I got to do my own homework there and see if there's a way or someplace I can go to find out if that extra, or actually looks like about $1 billion, whether it's $500 million or $1 billion, we'll find out, but how much of that came out of the private sector and damaged people who have been working in the industry and now are losing money to nonprofits. Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification to that. I think if I understood Representative Green's suggestion correctly, he was saying that the $2 billion might only be for publicly funded arts projects and that that could be competing with private sector ones. But if I heard you correct before, the survey was just of the general population just to figure out the impact of the arts in Minnesota, right? So that would presumably include both privately funded and publicly funded projects. So I guess I just don't see how that equates to somebody competing against somebody else.
Representative Freiberg, if you look at page 8 in your handout, the slide on the bottom, the $2 billion statewide economic impact, of the $2 billion statewide economic impact, $819 is the spending of nonprofit arts and culture organizations, not including any for-profits.
Okay.
The $564 million is audience spending of people going to and from nonprofit arts and culture events. The nonprofit arts and culture organizations that we looked at are generally grantees of the State Arts Board or regional arts councils primarily, and then secondly of the Minnesota Historical Society and its sub-granting programs, and then public broadcasting, science museums and children's museums, all nonprofits. We did not include any research about for-profits, so I can't answer that question.
You
maybe like the circus.
Any other questions from members? You know, the one slide that you had in here is the most telling to me is the $222 million returned to government from the arts is far, far more than the government spends on the arts. So you could truly say that this is one account we have that more than pays its own way.
Yes.
And Representative Lehman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't let this committee meeting adjourn without recognizing that David Marty's from my community and traveled down 3.5-4 hours to be here, and I appreciate that. He's here often representing the arts. And I think that a lot of success in rural communities, metro communities, has to do with leadership. And we're fortunate in our area to have lots of leaders in the arts, and so I appreciate that one of your sort of squishy metrics is the level of contribution that artists have. They have a higher level of contribution to their communities. I think that's true, at least in our community, we see that. And that resulted in the formation of an arts commission within the city of Grand Rapids. So just in recognizing that arts is part of economic development. Then I also wanted to make a point besides just recognizing Mr. Marty. And that is you've got good quantitative data here, which is really appreciated, especially important when you're getting state funding to be able to quantify who's receiving that and what the effect is. You might want to add some qualitative information as well, and I'm thinking to Mr. Green's point, might be helpful to talk to some for-profits to see what impact the funding has had on them. I'm thinking, for example, in our community, we have an event called, if you want to come to Grand Rapids, the first Friday of the month, we have an event called First Friday, where no matter what time of the year, if it's 30 below in January or 80 above in July, you can walk downtown and see live performances in for-profit shops. In the frame-up art gallery, for instance, or in a jewelry shop, or what have you, it might be interesting to see, you know, what impact arts events have had on for-profit businesses. The other impact that I can't quantify, but I feel in my gut, and I hear, you know, hearsay, is that for-profits have a better chance of attracting professionals and families to the community because there's a rich arts culture. There's more offerings for women. There's more offerings for family. There's dance programs for the kids and so on. So I think in that regard, the for-profit community has benefited by having an added dimension to the community. So just something for food for thought if you wanted to show, you know, for-profit impacts.
Thank you, Representative Lehman. I have seen research that shows that young people in particular, when they're looking for a new community, first look at the quality of life, including both arts and culture and outdoors opportunities. They decide where to live, and then they figure out how to live. So I will find that research and add it in.
Thank you, Mr. Sherry. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for a very good presentation. And with that, is there any other business to be brought before this committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.